That's Bobby Boubland, and he passed away. And so we want to remember him all 2 hours, playing all of our breaks. Music will be Bobby Boubland's music, one of the great blues artists of all time. Had the pleasure of seeing and listening to all these years, and had a voice like few others had. Just was amazing, an amazing talent. So we're going to be playing his songs going through. Very quickly run down this day in history. We talk about the racial divide in America. I often call one of those divides called the Custer Crazy Horse Divide. Over what happens between Native people and this country. This is the anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn that took place in 1876. Mm-hmm. Decisive battle that may have ended up killing Custer and a bunch of American soldiers, but it was the beginning of the end of Native American freedom in America, at least in the West. And that happened on this day in history. This was also the day that the controversial novel that many thought it was very deeply racist, Gone with the Wind, was published June 30th, 1936. And that happened, and it's this is also a day in 1968 that I witnessed. I wasn't arrested that day. I was almost arrested that day, but it was in 1968, and it was when the police came in and closed down Resurrection City, which was a place where blacks, whites, Puerto Ricans, Mexican Americans, white Americans, all poor people, gathered together to fight for economic, social, and racial justice in America. And over 100 people were arrested that day, some pretty violently. The National Guard came in and was mobilized all around the city to stop disturbances, and that was a very important movement that was on the heels of Martin Luther King's death. He wanted that to happen, and it's still a battle over how to create an interracial, racial justice and social justice, economic justice movement in America. Is that what we have? Yeah, I think that's what we have for today. Oh, that's right. On this day, Mary McLeod Bethune, was founder president of Bethune-Cookman College, was named director of Negro Affairs for the National Youth Administration. She was the first black woman to receive a major appointment in the federal government. This took place in the middle of World War II on January the 1st, 1944. Now we move into our topic of the day. Our topic here this morning is about the Zimmerman trial that's going to begin today. And we talked about it last Friday with Ben Crump and with one of our guests today, Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor for The Root, author and columnist, Aura Bogado, who is a blogger and writer for The Nation, where she writes about racial justice, Native rights, and immigration, and Douglas Colbert. Doug Colbert is professor of law here at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
Great to be here, Mark.
Great to be here.
Good to have you back, Laura. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We want to hear your thoughts. Jump onto our Facebook pages, which I'll be checking, or tweet us at Mark Steiner. Doug, you're in studio. Let me just ask you this question to lead off, because we were talking about this before we went into the show live. And Edward and Ben Crump and I talked about this a bit on Friday. It's the question of jury selection, which you see as an attorney is one of the most critical junctures in a trial, and your analysis of that and what that might mean for this trial.
Well, in my view, jury selection is the most important part of every criminal trial. And that's because while the jurors hear the same testimony and see the same witnesses, they often will interpret that testimony and credibility of witnesses much differently. And I'm particularly concerned and look at the racial composition of a jury in interracial crimes, and certainly the killing of Trayvon Martin is one that's going to require representation of the African-American community to ensure that the African-American community and others accept the verdict of a jury should it be one of not guilty. Historically, white jurors who either comprise the entire jury or who are the predominant members of a jury have not been able to provide justice to African-American crime victims. And we've seen this over and over again historically. So I think this morning the defense should feel quite good about the fact that five of the six jurors are white and the sixth is Hispanic. And that gives me pause, because I am extremely concerned as to how that jury will interpret the case. And I'm also concerned about how there's been so little attention in the media to the racial composition. We read about six women on the jury, but race is not really addressed until much later in most of the articles I've read.
Aura, you want to jump in on this for a minute before we...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that a lot of the way that we think about this case is justice for Trayvon Martin and what that really looks like, and whether we can even find that in the courtroom. All respect to my fellow guest and attorney on this call. You know, as we know, during the publicity questioning phase during the pretrial last week, one of the jurors indicated that she didn't read newspapers because she uses newspapers to line her parrot's cage. And in addition, we know that she cares for like a whole bunch of cats and dogs, and she has two lizards and a one-winged crow. And so this parrot lady, as she's been called, this woman that's too busy taking care of these exotic animals to care that a young, unarmed black child was shot to death, she's one of just six people who's going to be deciding whether or not George Zimmerman is guilty, right? She's also, she's had a concealed weapons permit in the past. Her husband currently has one. And so we already have an idea of the absurdity of what this trial might already turn into. And in fact, within the current system, as the court system exists today, we really need to ask ourselves whether even a perfect jury could really mean justice for Trayvon Martin, because Trayvon, this case isn't really just about Trayvon. He represents every black child, every young person of color that's gunned down with impunity. He represents those names that we don't know about, whose deaths we don't wear hoodies for, right? He represents every black man who's killed every 28 hours by vigilantes like Zimmerman or by cops. And so that's really what's at stake here. Justice for Trayvon Martin, real justice, means taking a hard and very critical look at ourselves as a society and at the system that allows the death of some people, and black people in particular, with impunity.
Edward?
Yes, I agree with everything that she said. I think that it's really troubling that the judge has ruled that the term racial profiling cannot be used in the court, in the course of the case, because basically that means that they're basically trying to delete the racial element. They've already done that quite successfully with the mostly white jury, right? But then beyond that, the way that the language is now going to be construed is going to place such a burden on the prosecution to prove that this was motivated as a result of race, which it really was. And so I think without accepting that, and then without people who on the jury who would implicitly understand that, whether or not those terms were used or not, because I would feel much more comfortable if you had a jury of at least half black people who wouldn't need to hear the term to understand what that means, right? Because they live it every day. Their sons, their brothers, their cousins live that experience, so they don't need to hear the term. But I think that without a clear discussion about the racial element of this case, and also, I think it was also reported that the 911 call wouldn't be heard in the course of the trial, which goes at the heart of the matter, because this man stalked the child beforehand, and there's evidence that he did that. So without that being admitted into evidence, I don't really understand how they're designing the case. And maybe the attorney can speak more to that, but all of this disturbs me.
And you raise these issues, Edward, and I do want to go back to Doug here on this, because one of the things that we were talked a bit before the show, but in my rereading the articles over the weekend and this morning early, what struck me was that the tenor of a lot of the articles seems to be that the judge was doing more for the prosecution than the defense. That's what it feels like in saying what's being denied, what's allowed in. But you're also, as you said earlier, they're also not allowing in expert witnesses that could really identify what's on the voices, not allowing in the 911 calls, which shows Zimmerman saying what he's saying and the police saying, stay away, don't go near him, and all that other stuff that was on the 911. And yeah. So you have your concerns, Doug, about this judge.
Well, I have concerns about the jury comes first, because those are the people who are going to render the verdict. And when you don't have African-American representation and the crime victim is African-American, there's a big issue right there. But in terms of the prosecutor and the judge, the prosecutor is used to prosecuting people who look like Trayvon Martin. That's the typical criminal defendant. Prosecutors have a much more difficult time capturing the crime when the victim is a 17-year-old young black man. The judge in this case, you know, is someone who her rulings, and of course I'm not in the courtroom, so my commentary is based on the fact that she excluded testimony from two prosecution expert witnesses who would have testified that the voice on that tape was Trayvon Martin and was not George Zimmerman. That's very important testimony for a jury to consider the credibility. The defense had their own witnesses, and so it becomes a question of...
Who are you going to believe?
Who are you going to believe? But right. The judge has said no expert testimony. Right. And then the judge repeatedly, according to the news reports, repeatedly reminds the jury that you must find the defendant not guilty if the prosecution's not able to disprove the self-defense claim that Zimmerman's putting forward. Those are words that defense lawyers want to hear from judge in every case. We want the judge to say, you know, should you have a reasonable doubt, you must.
Right.
Now, most judges don't do that. Most judges say if the prosecution has proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt, you must find the defendant guilty. So the word guilty comes across, but in this particular trial, at least according to the news reports, it's the not guilty that the jurors are hearing.
So those of us in America, Aura and Edward, that are and I know you are as well, Doug, but are concerned about racial justice, but also concerned about what could be the outcome of a trial like this. How we're beginning is really troubling.
Yes, it's the precedent. It's the precedent that's set. And, you know, Attorney Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Trayvon Martin's family, like that we spoke to, and that you know I've been in constant touch with, made this point, and I talked about it in one of my pieces, which is that this essentially, the way that it's set up, it's scary because it seems like we may not get a fair judgment out of this, particularly in light of the fact that it's a mostly white jury. One of the other guests was making the point, some of these people are sort of out of touch and out to lunch. But beyond that, what will that say for other potential vigilantes or cops in this society who can act with impunity and violence in their violence toward young black males? I think it's the precedent that's far more destructive here. I wrote a piece a while ago talking about Emmett Till, and I asked whether or not the parents should release a photo of the dead Trayvon with a bullet in his chest, because I was so disturbed by all the images of George Zimmerman being bloodied, and it feeds into what the attorney was just saying about this idea that if they can't disprove self-defense, if you can't disprove self-defense, you need to show the real starkness, I think, of what occurred here. And I think the image of a dead Trayvon then meets the bloodied images of a George Zimmerman.
Right.
And I think without that kind of imagery, or without the language, without giving the proper testimonies from experts, all of these things that are being denied, the racial profiling term, then without those images, what will this jury be basing their decision on?
And Aura, I'm curious to pick up on that point and what you are going to be looking for in these coming weeks on our way to pick to our listeners on the phones here. Aura?
Yeah, I'm sort of keeping track of different communities. You know, you started the show recalling history and the Battle of Little Bighorn. And
right.
Just so that we're clear, you know, there's these early voting satellite centers in Montana, and they were placed everywhere last year, 2012, except on reservations, right? And the person that was actually responsible for that decision and refused to change her mind to allow early voting on these reservations is actually the spouse of a direct descendant of General Custer, right? And we need to remember the role that race plays historically and the currency that it still carries in the United States of America. This isn't just something that happened last year or a couple of years ago. We can't fool ourselves and try to imagine that race isn't crucial to life and the way that we live life in the United States, right? And I was just a kid living in Los Angeles during the Rodney King trial, but I recognize already this feeling from my community 20 years later, living as an adult now here in New York, this frustration, this the parrot lady, sort of these things that just really, they make perfect sense simply because they don't. And so what I'm really going to sort of try and keep an eye on is the way that communities are responding, particularly with the use of social media, right? Because I feel like folks on both coasts, New York and Los Angeles, or communities here, which I'm a part of, which I'm sort of really tapped into, there's definitely already some talk that people are like, we're not having it, we're not having it. And I don't know exactly what that means, but again, this trial, this Trayvon Martin, justice for Trayvon Martin, means a lot for a lot of people. And I'm a bit worried about the way that folks, you know, may respond from what we know so far about this jury and this judge.
Now, Doug, go ahead. I do want to get the phones. People are trying to get in this conversation. I want to get
just a quick point, which is Aura makes a very important point. This is a crime against the African-American community as much as all people who care for impartial justice. That doesn't mean that I also want to make sure that Zimmerman gets a fair trial. But my biggest concern here is that the person who was killed may not be adequately represented in that courtroom. And I'm wondering why, you know, the two black jurors that the defense struck, and they struck two black women, and the prosecution struck one black male. Now, I wasn't in the courtroom. I don't know the reasons at all. But I understand why the defense would want to strike two women who are African-American. Don't understand why the prosecution would strike the only African-American male. But unfortunately, this is the way you must look at these interracial crimes. And that's what's so disturbing to me. It's almost like every person who's reporting on this, except, of course, for our guests, are excluding the conversation about race. And it's so important to make sure that a verdict is respected. I don't think we can respect a verdict which doesn't have the community on that jury.
So I want to apologize to my listeners here for a moment. We lost the people who were calling in. They were waiting to get on. Please call back. We'll get you right on, 410-319-8888. Jim, if you want to call back, I'll make sure you get on immediately, see what you have to say. 410-319-8888. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com. And I will log on to Facebook here and see what you are saying as well. And I know, Edwin, when you and I spoke last week, and we're all talking about something when we weren't on the air, and I was talking to other people over the weekend about the same issue, is that this is some people are trying to make this look as if it's O.J. Simpson redux.
Mm.
And I think that what's interesting, though, when you look at the polls right now, that the majority of Americans think that Zimmerman was guilty.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let's go to the phones. I did promise. Everybody's calling back in. Hold that thought. We're going to go right back. 410-319-8888. Jim, you're on the air. Something's going on with the phones. Okay, let me know when we can take a caller. Just send me a note. Chat me. And go ahead. You're going to say, Edward, go ahead.
Yes, I think that... you know, I still have very mixed feelings about the O.J. Simpson trial, but I certainly think that there's something cruel and insidious about comparing that murder trial to what occurred to this child. I think that there's something, and this is something that's been bothering me about this case to begin with, and you and I have discussed this. And I think it was Trayvon's mother who said to me when I interviewed her a couple of months ago, that the idea that her skinny little child, her skinny teenage boy, was an equal threat to a grown man with a gun is just ludicrous. And I think to see Trayvon as just a black male is problematic. We need to see Trayvon as a black child. And so regardless of whether or not O.J. was guilty and whether or not, so if O.J. got off, now Zimmerman can get off, so it's equal justice or equal injustice, I think would be the undercurrent of that sort of argument. I think that it's just an unfair comparison, and I think that we really need to see what happened to this child being stalked in the dark by a man who thought he was a criminal and then took it upon himself to exact vigilante justice is more akin to, from me at least, what happened in Newtown. The shattering of babies. I think that when we begin to see black children as victims and black boys as children and not black males or black men, then we can begin to have some parity here in the conversation around what really occurred on that night.
Aura, I think what Edward said is just both culturally, socially, emotionally on point.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's really a false equivalency. O.J. Simpson never said, yes, I killed Nicole Brown Simpson in self-defense, right? And this is George Zimmerman's claim, that he killed a child. We need to remember, as my fellow guest just pointed out, we need to remember that this is a child. This is a young child that was killed by an armed man. We need to remember who was armed and who was unarmed. And the fact that George Zimmerman then went on to say, well, you know, I felt threatened. And I think it echoes this idea, this anxiety over black bodies, right? That certain bodies in and of themselves are weapons. And I think that that we can recall from cases like the Rodney King trial, right, where the defense argued his body was in fact a weapon, that, you know, just being on the ground was enough of a threat that the officers felt compelled to defend themselves against the actual presence of his body, right? And I think that it's that same kind of logic that's really rooted in white supremacy since the founding of this nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's really part of what's at stake here.
Let's go to the phones and go right to Doug. 410-319-8888. Marie, you're on the air. Hi, Marie, you're on the air. Marie, you there?
Hello.
You're on the air, Marie.
Oh, good morning,
good
all.
Good morning.
This case bothered me at the very beginning. I want to say this, too. They didn't mention so far in the proceedings, what I've seen on the TV, about the phone call that Trayvon made to his girlfriend that he was being attacked. If they would play that recording, that would blow this case away, and Trayvon would be honored, you know. You know, would be proven that he's not guilty. Because he told his girlfriend that he's being pursued by this man. And I think she told him to run. So why haven't they brought that up? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
No, and I think they will bring that up. I think certainly I expect the girlfriend will testify. I think the conversation will come into the evidence. And I would expect the prosecutor to even get the tape itself of the person who was screaming. Absent the expert witnesses, of course, that diminishes that testimony. But what's important here is for the prosecutor to be representing the people of the community, the same prosecutor who represents so much in the name of the community. So whether he's capable of doing this is really is one question. The Rodney King comparison comes much closer to this situation. I just want to point out that the state jury had no African Americans, 11 whites, when the state jury failed to convict any of the officers. But the federal jury that did convict two of the officers had four African Americans on that jury. Same evidence, same witnesses, different outcomes.
Go ahead, Edward.
Professor Douglas, Professor Colbert, is it possible that there could be a federal case if this fails in state court?
It's possible, but I will point out that the federal jurisdiction is rarely invoked in these state situations. I mean, I would, and I hope we never get to that point. I hope, you know, the jury is able to hear the evidence, as we all should be listening to the evidence. But, yes, it's possible.
So we have a couple of minutes only left in the segment. I know that two of our guests have to run, but I'm going to try to get this question out very quickly. I mean, what you just said, Doug, what's the dynamic that changes the nature of how juries deliberate if the jury is interracial?
You know, I remember what Thurgood Marshall once said to his fellow justices. It's that stories are not told unless they're told by the people who experience things themselves. So all the jurors, all the white jurors and the one Hispanic may be very nice people, but they don't have the same life experiences. And having the studies show that if you have three jurors on a 12-person jury, and I would suggest two jurors on a 6-person jury who are African-American, there's a whole different deliberation that occurs in assessing the evidence.
And, Aro, I know we have to run. We're about to take a break here, but could you give us a closing thought?
Yes, of course. And, you know, to echo a lot of what Professor Colbert and Edward have said, and this focus on the fact that all the jurors are women, that at least four of them are mothers, you know, I think that it is important to take into account what if we did have two black mothers, right, who probably have a certain sense of fear when their sons don't check in if they're of a certain age and out on the street. I think that would be something that might compel a jury in a different way. So we have yet to see how this will play out.
Well, we'll continue this look, obviously. Aura Bogada is a blogger and writer for The Nation, which writes about racial justice, Native American rights, and immigration, and Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor to The Root, author, columnist, and Doug Colbert, who is professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Thank you all so much. It's been great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll all be talking very soon. We'll continue this look, and we'll have some of these guests back as we see what the Supreme Court decides in the next day or two around voting rights, affirmative action, and gay rights, which will be huge, we think, and we'll find out. Stay with us. We're going to come back from this break and talk about a group in Baltimore that is looking to teach issues around racial justice. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Further on up the road, someone's going to hurt you like you hurt me.